My experience testifies to the truth of Professor Kimball's observations. When my husband and I joined the church in 1955 in England, we were very fortunate to have missionaries who were willing to discuss our questions. We would argue well into the night, and I can't tell you how important that was to us, to be free to ask questions, no matter what they were or how uncomfortable they might be, because questions don't go away. We're still good friends with many of those missionaries after 37 years, and sometimes we carry on the same old debates with the adjustments that the years have brought. Gary Smith was one of those missionaries, and he is the person I'm working on the book with. So for me, the church was a wonderful adventure of mind and spirit. It encouraged a hunger for truth, and it expanded my horizons. And my whole experience after joining the church in England was a voyage of discovery. And much that I read at the time encouraged that search for truth. For example, in 1963, I was visiting teacher to an elderly lady who came to church only infrequently. One day she gave me a little book which she had treasured for a long time. It seemed that in 1937, President Heber J. Grant visited the British Isles on the occasion of the centenary of church missionary activity in Britain. While there, he came across a little book called The Power of Truth, written by William Jordan. Its author was not a member of the church, but President Grant was so impressed with the message of the book that he purchased the copyright and gave one of the books to every officer working in the church in England at that time. This is one of those books, and it's almost like a Bible to me. There are several wonderful essays besides the one giving the book its title. For example, The Courage to Face Ingratitude, The Conquest of the Preventable, The Companionship of Tolerance, and The Way of the Reformer. But President Grant told the recipients to read especially the first one, The Power of Truth. The opening paragraph reads, "Truth is the rock foundation of every great character. It is loyalty to the right as we see it. It is courageous living of our lives in harmony with our ideals. It is always power." But then the author goes on to say, "The man who has a certain religious belief and fears to discuss it, lest it may be proved wrong, is not loyal to his belief. He has but a coward's faithfulness to his prejudices." Hubie Brown also encouraged what he called the eternal quest. In 1958, I read of a speech he gave at BYU in which he said, "We are grateful in the church and in this great university that the freedom, dignity, and integrity of the individual is basic in church doctrine. Here we are free to think and express our opinions. Fear will not stifle thought, as in the case in some areas which have not yet emerged from the dark ages." That statement gave encouragement, little needed perhaps, to the spontaneous exchanges and challenges and debates that constituted our Sunday school classes and Relief Society meetings. When we moved to Salt Lake City in 1967, I was surprised to discover how smoothly the lessons went. It was as if all truth was there and there was no need to question. But for me, it wasn't as exciting, nor was it very enlightening. So, encouraged by my daughter, I went to the University of Utah, and when we moved to Los Angeles, transferred to UCLA. After graduation, Gary Smith contacted me and asked if I'd be interested in researching the Office of Patriarch. I jumped at the chance of further adventures. For one thing, I liked doing research. Another thing was that I'd received my patriarchal blessing from his father in 1959, added to which there had not been any written history of the patriarchs, and since the office had been retired, there should be a record, otherwise it was likely that the history of the office would simply be buried. Besides which, I was confronted by my ever-present why. Why had this singular office been retired? So I began a wonderful journey of several years, which included going back to UCLA graduate school. I'd like to share with you some of the illuminating discoveries that were mine during that time of intensive research, and how I was caused to dig a little more deeply and more broadly into Mormon history, into general ecclesiastical history, 19th century Mormon American history, and sociological theory, all in the interest of my study of the patriarchs, merely one aspect of church history. First of all, I looked at official historical references to the presiding patriarchs of the church, and there I discovered William Smith, younger brother of the prophet and third patriarch to the church. I hadn't heard of him before. He was excommunicated after less than 5 months in office, and so was seldom mentioned in church manuals or magazines. The descriptions of William in official church histories, however, were pretty awful, so of course he intrigued me. I started searching for reasons why he was described as violent, profligate, wicked, unstable, licentious, etc. This was going to be interesting. At first, I found that the characterizations were not without foundation. But then I began looking beyond William and at his fellow apostles and church leaders in general during these early years of the church. There I found that all but two of them, Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball, had been excommunicated, some several times, for similar kinds of behavior, either immorality or rebellion, or for some very trivial things too. And some had been guilty of violence. Even Joseph Smith and Brigham Young had indulged in violent behavior at times. For instance, Benjamin Johnson, who was a great admirer of the prophet, said of Joseph, "In the early days at Kirtland and elsewhere, one or another of his associates were more than once, for their impudence, helped from the congregation by his foot." And at one time at a meeting at Kirtland for insolence, he soundly thrashed his brother William, who had boasted himself as invincible. End of quote. Apostle David Patton tells of being slapped and kicked out of the yard by the prophet. And at one time, Brigham Young threatened an apostate with a cowhide. As for the kind of crude speech attributed to William, that seemed fairly common, especially when one reads some of the speeches or comments of Brigham Young or Heber C. Kimball. Stanley Ivins has a whole collection of those. Then I looked at the larger scene in 19th century America, and I discovered that this behavior was largely a reflection of frontier life at that time, perhaps less in evidence in Mormonism, but still culturally permissible. Can you imagine today, for instance, a general authority being dragged from the stand in general conference by a member who had been offended by his remarks? That happened to Joseph Sr., and William Smith came to the aid of his father and was himself restrained by other members of the 12. And there are other stories. After recognizing this 19th century context, I looked at the picture of William differently. I read of his valiant defense of his father on other occasions, as told by Lucy Mack, his mother. I read appreciative reports of his speeches at local church conferences and of his eloquence as representative for Hancock County in the state legislature of Illinois. And I realized that he had been doomed by his independent and rebellious spirit and by his insistent claims for what he perceived to be the rights of the Smith family during a time of crisis and difficult transition in church leadership. He was excommunicated October 1845, accused of aspiring to the presidency of the church, and his reputation since then has drawn upon these unsavory characteristics as if they were uniquely his. While much that is recounted is based on fact, there is no acknowledgement that he was not alone among the church hierarchy in his imperfections. The patriarch who followed William appeared to be one-dimensional, too, from official church histories, and still I started digging. In reading about Uncle John Smith, brother of Joseph Sr., who followed William as patriarch, I found the antithesis of William. History remembers John as faithful, dedicated, and obedient. But then history also reveals that he was willing to forego any claims to primacy in the office of patriarch. But there was another side, too, to this very dedicated man. Without taking anything away from Uncle John, who had endured his share of trials, it does seem that some vices go with certain virtues. In his determination to do all things in righteousness, he was very intolerant of wrongdoers. His letters to his son George A. are full of concern about the saint's inability to live up to the standards the Lord had set, and he often attributes the troubles of the early church to the members' unrighteousness. At least twice at high council trials, Uncle John had insisted that the guilty parties make full public confession in church periodicals. Sidney Rigdon suggested that Uncle John would spread darkness rather than light upon the subject, and the prophet laboured with his uncle, who admitted an error in judgment. Patty Sessions, whose journal is an absolute delight in its honesty, especially when she talks about her husband's new wife, tells of John being careful not to become involved in the unofficial Women's Relief Society meetings, of which he was somewhat suspicious. Uncle John was a stickler for detail and proper procedure, to a fault perhaps, and Brigham Young's sense of humour was displayed in a meeting with Uncle John during the exodus to Utah. Hosea Stout writes in his diary, "The subject of the beef committee was taken up on the complaint of Father John Smith, who was not satisfied with some things about it. The thing was talked out of countenance, and finally, President Brigham Young moved to have the whole matter laid over till the first resurrection, and then burn the papers the day before." But Uncle John kept a wonderful, poignant journal, wherein he humbly acknowledges his own shortcomings. And his blessings as patriarch were very deeply appreciated and were comforting, as can be seen from the tributes paid by Eliza R. Snow and others. Eliza wrote a poem about him, as did John Lyon. John entered into plural marriage, although undoubtedly devoted to Clarissa, his wife, but there are few references in his letters or in his journal to the part that she or any of the other wives played in his life. On the other hand, in the case of the fifth patriarch, young John Smith, son of Hiram, his wife figures prominently in his journals and letters. How I would love to have met Helen Smith, so honest and feisty and real. For a while, John resisted pressure to enter into plural marriage, until, according to Helen, Brigham Young told John to get another wife. When he did finally take one other wife, the relationship with Nancy Melissa Lemon did not last long. The letters exchanged between John and Helen, and some written by each of them to John's half-brother, Joseph F. Smith, are quite funny and often touching. One from Helen to her brother-in-law in 1857 reports, "Well, John has got another wife. Dear Joseph, it was a trial to me, but thank the Lord it's over with. I don't care how many he gets now. The ice is broke, as the old saying is. The more, the greater the glory. All of the girls is a getting married from 10 to 18. If there is any left till they're 18, they're on the old maid's list." One month later, she wrote to John saying, "Talk about me apostatizing. God forgive me, for I am a Latter-day Saint. But the Lord knows that I am no polygamist, and with the help of the Lord, I will have nothing to do with it. Can you understand that?" Helen reminds John that he wanted to know her mind, so he mustn't complain if she tells him. And later, a letter from Helen to John warned him, "John, when you left, you said you would go away, and when I came back, I would be a better girl. For better or for worse, you will find me changed from a weak girl to a strong-minded woman that will have her rights, if there are any rights for a woman." While John was serving a mission in Denmark in 1863, one of his letters to Helen refers to the subject of plural marriage. responding to her offer to give him two more wives if she could choose them, and to do all in her power for his good and comfort without a word of complaint. And after thanking her for her kindness, John refuses her offer, saying, "For the present, allow me to say that I have wives enough." John's reluctance to fully embrace plural marriage was one reason why he was not received into the Salt Lake School of the Prophets in 1883. It was said he had not lived his religion. Besides the fact that he smoked, the minutes note that although he had two wives, he only lived with one. But when Helen died in 1909, John wrote to his cousin, Joseph Smith III, saying how lonely he was. Though not keen on the idea of remarrying, he said, "The one to fill Helen's place don't come along as yet, and to get a substitute would be difficult. We had been married 54 years, less 3 months, 22 days. Yet John's plural wife was still alive and listed as his widow in his own obituary 18 months later. But John was criticized for other reasons. One complaint was that he was not magnifying his calling. The fact that he gave 20,659 blessings during his 50 years in office suggests that the real explanation for such condemnation had to be more complex. Then in general conference, John was publicly called to repentance by President Wilford Woodruff and Heber J. Grant because he didn't keep the word of wisdom. In an October 1894 conference talk, President Woodruff said, "Here I see the presiding patriarch of the church close to me. If he cannot keep the commandments of God, we will have to get another patriarch of the church. If he cannot put away his tobacco and smoking, he'd better resign." While this charge was warranted, it is difficult to understand why the patriarch was singled out for censure. At that time, obedience to the word of wisdom was not strictly required. In fact, Brigham Young had warned against coercion. Wilford Woodruff himself had recorded in his journal the remarks of Brigham Young in 1841. "Shall I break the word of wisdom if I go home and drink a cup of tea? No, wisdom is justified of her children, and all concluded that a forced abstinence was not making us free, but we should be under bondage with a yoke upon our necks." When John Smith was enjoying tobacco, several of the other general authorities were also having difficulties in trying to live the word of wisdom, and it was not until Heber J. Grant became president that so much emphasis was placed upon it and that it later became a temple recommend requirement. So why had John been singled out for censure in that 19th century climate? When I looked into John's life more closely, he emerged as a deeply compassionate human being, one who probably cared much more about people than institutional rules and procedures. Letters written and received by him reveal that he was trusted completely. I have a photocopy of a letter received by his son after John had died, and it echoes the sentiments of earlier letters written while John was still alive, so it was not simply one of those funeral talks. "Tongue cannot tell how I feel at the passing of your father. As you know, he was one of the best friends I ever had. I learned to love him from my boyhood. We've spent many an hour in conversation leading to the great principles of eternal life. I found him to be one of the greatest men that ever lived. In this way, he had a good word for man, woman, and child, and even those who persecuted us he spoke well of. He had flowing in his veins some of that noble blood that his master had when he said, 'Father, forgive them, they know not what they do.' How often has he, when people complained, turned and given them a blessing? We all love him, and we shall all miss him. There was nothing boasting about him. He was simply Patriarch John Smith. It seems to me it took his departure to have his name or picture in a paper. Yet he held one of the greatest offices in the church. There was no pomp or display about him. He was plain, humble. He was like the stream that found its way to the great ocean. Look, the ocean of friends he had. It is friend, John, on every hand. not only by our people, but by all who knew him. So all the official condemnation intrigued me. One explanation may be that he was loyal to his extended family, including those members of the Smith family who had become affiliated with the reorganized church. His letters to them show affection and honest concern, besides a real integrity and loyalty to the church. But he was especially close to Joseph Smith III, president of the reorganized church, with whom he had grown up in Nauvoo until the exodus to Utah, when they were both 14 years of age. Letters and journals show this relationship was troubling to some, who were concerned that John might be a Josephite. But later, it seemed to me that perhaps there was more to it than that. Hiram G. Smith, the sixth patriarch, ironically provided some clues. I say ironically because Hiram G. was a paragon of virtue by any standard of the church. He was happily married, a man of intellectual and spiritual strength. He was faithful, and he was a person of integrity. He was admired by those he served, including the church hierarchy, but in his efficiency and dedication, he highlighted the fundamental difficulty presented by this particular office. He presided over state patriarchs. He issued circulars containing directions, and he presided at meetings of patriarchs even when general authorities were present. He also questioned the current order of sustaining authorities at general conference. This question brought renewed discomfort and much debate among the 12, even though the same question had been raised by President Joseph F. Smith in 1901. President Smith had referred to Doctrine and Covenants 124, where the patriarch was offered for sustaining before the 12, in fact, even before the prophet. Hiram Smith had magnified his calling, and therein lay the problem. His understanding of the nature of the office of presiding patriarch was in full accord with scripture and precedent, yet when he died in 1932, President Heber J. Grant and the 12 could not reach agreement about the office, and the result was an impasse which was to last 10 years. And the stage was set then for the demise of the office. The sociological theories of Max Weber helped me find one possible explanation for all of this. Hiram G. Smith had brought into focus the problem of trying to accommodate an hereditary, charismatic calling within a complex modern institution where leaders are appointed by mediated authority. The calling of patriarch initially had its roots in Old Testament tribal societies, defined by Joseph Smith even for the Latter-day Church as having primal characteristics. The early charismatic Mormon movement could accommodate such a calling, but the fast-growing international church had different needs. One of these needs was predictability and a degree of control over who would occupy any position of leadership. With an hereditary calling short of immorality or apostasy, accession to the office remained a right, one that President Joseph Fielding Smith maintained was, quote, inherent in the blood. While Hiram G. Smith had not in any sense sought the presidency of the church, in taking seriously his responsibility to preside as patriarch, he had raised the specter of the possibility of another, such as William Smith, waiting in the wings who might claim primal authority. One general authority had voiced such concern. So I was finding different answers from those I had anticipated. After all of this digging, instead of uncovering some conspiracy against the Smiths, which it had seemed in the beginning, or some other such power struggle, I began to see something that might be inevitable, perhaps built in right from the beginning, a problem arising from the evolution of a church that had its roots in an ancient familial patriarchal leadership to one that had become a worldwide institution requiring a greater degree of control and a necessary adherence to organizational rules. All that remained was my wish that it might have been possible to acknowledge some of the struggles in trying to come to terms with the present incompatibility of this office. Instead, The saints were given the opportunity to second-guess the reasons for the 10-year hiatus and final demise of the office, sometimes to the detriment of the good name of those who held it. We do the gospel, I believe, a disservice when we see only the hand of the Lord in our history, disallowing any possibility of flawed decisions, when we do not allow for human frailty or simple ignorance, or when we fail to acknowledge practical explanations for human decisions based upon institutional needs. By refusing to see the combination of the human and the divine in our church, or even to see humanity's struggles themselves at every level as a part of the divine plan, we're cheating ourselves of much that is the foundation of that plan, and we are disallowing ourselves the opportunity to appreciate those same leaders in their burdens and trials. So many stories could be told about many of our leaders, stories that have helped me recognize their humanity. As for my patriarchs, I have developed a deep affection for them and for their wives in all their valiant struggles. And my longing now is to feel some sympathy for all church leaders in their own individual attempts to find the Lord's way in a very complex world. Phyllis McGinley said, "The wonderful thing about saints," and she meant the early saints, "is that they were human. They lost their tempers, scolded God, were egotistical or testy or impatient in their turns, made mistakes and regretted them. Still, they went on doggedly blundering toward heaven." One of the first books we bought after joining the church was a history by B.H. Roberts, and in a preface he made this statement. He said, "It is always a difficult task to hold the scales of justice at an even balance when weighing the deeds of men. It becomes doubly more so when dealing with men engaged in a movement that one believes had its origin with God, and that its leaders, on occasion, act under the inspiration of God. Under such conditions, to so state events as to be historically exact, and yet on the other hand, so treat the course of events as not to destroy faith in these men nor in their work, becomes a task of extreme delicacy, and one that tries the soul and skill of the historian. The only way such a task can be accomplished in the judgment of the writer is to frankly state events as they occurred, in full consideration of all related circumstances, allowing the line of condemnation or of justification to fall where it may. Being confident that in the sum of things, justice will follow truth, and God will be glorified in his work, no matter what may befall individuals or groups of individuals. This the writer freely confesses has been the purpose of his work. Not the vindication of men before the bar of history, but the justification of the ways of God to man, and to prove that God is true, though all men have to be condemned as weaklings or even liars." And Roberts writes of the treasure of the gospel, which has to be carried in earthen vessels. "I have come to realize that our faith cannot be vested in those earthen vessels, nor can it be dependent upon history. Our leaders, besides serving as vehicles for the Lord's messages to the world, are human beings sometimes at the mercy of their own experience and culture. Our history is a reminder of the costs, the sacrifices, the joys and the trials and the complexities faced by those human beings. Our church is not an end in itself, it is simply an arena, providing the opportunities for each one of us to find our way to a knowledge of the ultimate concern of a loving Father in heaven. The gospel itself is the shining thread that can lead us there. We diminish the beauty when we feel we must shut out any aspect of the truth that may be discomforting, but which might in the end give us greater perspective and understanding. Truth is perhaps the most elusive goal in history, because it is so multifaceted, and because those who write it are creatures of their time and place and experience, and because we cannot read the minds or motivations of the participants in the drama. However, I believe that the search is worth the struggle, not just because I hunger for truth, but because it helps me realize that my role is not to judge, but to try to understand. My daughter-in-law and I were discussing epitaphs, and she said perhaps mine might be Seeker for Truth. But later, after thinking it over, I decided instead on Seeker of Understanding. That, I think, is the essence of my own 37-year journey since joining the church. The process in which I have been involved helps me realize that ultimately our faith has to rest in God, the Eternal Father, and in His Son, Jesus Christ, rather than depending upon borrowed light. In other words, this adventure in Mormon history has taught me the value of something called for by Boyd K. Packer 2 years ago when he announced the church's course correction. Brother Packer pointed out that in the church we have consistently encouraged temporal independence and that now was the time when we must begin to develop a spiritual independence. I just wish I could convey how exhilarating and enriching my journey has been, still is, as my search for truth and understanding and compassion goes on, and how infinitely grateful I am to you, my fellow travelers. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to have been asked to make some informal comments in response to Mrs. Bates' paper. At the outset, I'd like to state, however, that I comment very largely as an outsider here, because although I was trained in part as an historian, and although I am LDS, I do not view myself as a Mormon historian. Mormon history, if I understand it correctly, is largely about a body of facts with which I have only the familiarity that one can acquire through a roughly 15-year tenure in the church, and deals with a body of work with which I am largely unfamiliar. I am aware, however, of one of the most heated of the historiographic debates, if that's the correct term for it, that goes on within Mormon history, and that's the one upon which Mrs. Bates and her paper have focused. I thought that she did so with tremendous dignity and diplomacy, and I hope that I'm now, as an outsider, able to add some comments that would in some way add some insight to the paper that has already been presented. I enjoyed reading the paper when I was preparing this talk. I enjoyed the quotations. I found them enlightening and very well chosen. I did also find the discussions of the lives of the various patriarchs to be very informative. Several of them, however, did raise questions in my mind, which Mrs. Bates might want either to explore in her book, or perhaps if I could ask her to address in some short measure after I'm done speaking here. The first of those, which arose during her discussion of the patriarch that I referred to as John the Fifth, for no better reason than that was his order, and most of them had the same surname, was where the church drew the line then, and perhaps where the church draws the line now. This is kind of almost a social history sort of question. In terms of lives that exhibit some flaws or some deviations from the ideal, between those who are viewed by the church and by the church's members as flawed insiders and those who come to be viewed instead as outsiders. It sounds like John V was kind of on the borderline there in a number of places, and I was kind of wondering how he stayed there. The only other issue that I think was a little bit unclear was that if I understood some references correctly, Max Weber and his adumbrated theory about some of the structural elements in the development of institutions, including the church's patriarchate, would suggest that there were something other than personal and something other than entirely neutral explanations for the decline in the power of some of the patriarchs that were described there. In the sense of Hiram the Sixth, or in his case, I thought that this made a lot of sense. If I understood correctly, I thought, however, that there was also a suggestion that this might have played some role in the diminution of the power of John the Fifth, and because there were very few strong suggestions among the data that were cited in the paper that would explain how he sought to expand his power at all, I wondered how the Weberian thesis would apply to him, or whether Mrs. Bates really would not begin to apply that theory until we have the advent of Hiram. I agree, as a general matter, with both the thesis and the conclusion of the paper, which, if I understood them correctly, is that Mormon history, at its best, is a history which, rather than ignoring the flaws of prominent individuals in the history of the Church, places these flaws within the fuller context of the individual's aims, ambitions, cultural background, struggles, sacrifices, and genuinely honorable achievements, recognizing, I suppose, these individuals' humanity, but also the fact that in the service of their God, these individuals often did their best and sought to do even better. In view of the historiographic dispute that I understand goes on within Mormon history between those who believe that our history must be unalloyedly inspiring and those who believe that it should also reflect negative experiences as well, I found Mrs. Bates' quotations of various statements about truth to be very enlightening. Wanted to share another one, actually, that I thought she might enjoy, one that I had enjoyed when I read it on my mission. It is from Joseph F. Smith's Gospel Doctrine collection, and it is the opening sentence of the book. "Our hope of salvation," he wrote, actually he stated at a conference in 1917, "must be founded upon the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, for we cannot build upon error and ascend into the courts of eternal truth and enjoy the glory and exaltation of the kingdom of our God. That cannot be done." I liked these statements, both the one I read and very certainly the ones that Mrs. Bates had chosen, because they comported very well with my understanding or my training as to how history was to be approached. Where I was at school, the professors inveighed very strongly against those who approached history with preconceived notions about what its results should be, those who believed that all historical data had to fit into a set of preconceived theses. I was taught instead that the way to approach data when one did original research was to gather it, midway through the gathering process, look at it, and if you weren't inclined to ask yourself what the hell was going on here, you were not approaching your job correctly. I think that with great diplomacy, as I said, and with great tact, Mrs. Bates has pointed out a very good path for Mormon historians to follow. There are two issues, however, upon which I would like to comment where I think the paper might be able to go a bit further. One is that the paper itself was largely inward-looking, if I understood it correctly. At least in terms of its introduction and its conclusion, it was very personal and described both in the case of the writer and also for all of us how it is that we can prevent our own loss of faith. If I understand the historiographic debate that was initiated by some of the general authorities of the Church correctly, however, part of the problem and part of the idea is the contention that our history should be unalloyedly inspiring so that it will inspire those who are not yet members of the Church to become members of the Church. This is a position with which I have some sympathy because I am myself a convert, and I was originally attracted to the Church by perhaps an excessively rosy view of the goodness of all of the members in it. That may not have been borne out in every experience that I've had, but I'm very glad that insofar as I misunderstood, I misunderstood. I think that in approaching the issue of how many faults should be portrayed in discussions of our Church's prior leaders, we also do have at least to deal with the issue of the degree to which some of these accounts could have the effect of putting off those who read them. I'm not sure, however, that even having thought about that, I reach a different conclusion. And again, I return here for support to Joseph F. Smith, who at another conference said, "I have no fears in my heart or mind that that which is called Mormonism, which is indeed the gospel of Jesus Christ, will not bear the scrutiny of science and the researches of the learned and the literate into all truth." My own experience is that it has been borne up in those non-Mormon history areas where I have subjected it to that sort of analysis. But I think that those who write Mormon history are obligated, if we can extend, or if I may take the liberty of extending Mrs. Bates' paper into this second area that I've identified, to remember that along with the inclusion of the negative comes the obligation to fulfill the parameters or to abide by the parameters which Mrs. Bates has outlined, that the negative has to be put in the context, a full context that includes prevailing cultural standards, the belief and devotion of the people who committed the negative acts, whatever their flaws, of their aims, and perhaps even of their gradual maturation and improvement. I think our general authorities are right to inveigh against those whose works dwell upon the flaws exclusively. These two are incomplete histories because they fail to do justice to the balance with which history should be approached. I think that all of us, if we personalize this, would be very sorry to find that our lives had been judged in print on our own weakest moments. The second area, which is more substantive, in which I think Mrs. Bates and those who will pursue Mormon history need to do a little work and need to expand some thoughts, is that I found as I read this, and again, as I confess at the beginning, my exposure to Mormon history is quite limited, that it seemed to me, both from this and from what limited exposure I had had, that much of Mormon history seems to consist of biography. And of course, it's very easy to achieve, if one works at it, the sort of balance that Mrs. Bates is talking about in biography. I haven't seen as many social histories, sociometric studies, psychohistories, or institutional histories. Mrs. Bates does advert to an institutional historical aspect of it when she talks about the decline of the patriarchate and adverts to Max Weber. I wasn't entirely sure that I found the paper satisfying in its efforts to address the tension that would arise between the Weberian and the divine, if I can characterize them as that, or explain how it is that the combination of the human and the divine, or the institutional and the divine, would work themselves out in this case. I'd be very interested, in fact, to see how one could make these comport. But these are issues that I presume as Mormon history expands and includes more than the heavily biographical, Mormon historians will have to confront. I'm not sure how they should be applied, but I certainly think that the mandates of Mrs. Bates' paper should be applied to these other areas as well. And I think that as church members and as Mormon historians who are not members of the church do that, they will come much closer to being able to describe and to depict for us a very fair view of Mormon history. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did Mrs. Bates, did you have any comments you wanted to make before we take questions from the floor? I think she's trying to understand the question before she formulates an answer.
Young John, you mean?
Yeah. Whether he was an insider or an outsider, I'm not sure. He wanted to know where the line fell between the insider and the outsider, John Smith, young John Smith, John the Fifth. I'm not really sure because John's correspondence puts him firmly in the camp, the LDS camp. He's very loyal to the church, and he had a lot of correspondence with both Joseph Smith III of the Reorganized Church and Alexander, the prophet's son, about plural marriage. And he, even though he himself didn't appreciate it very much, he was still very loyal to the church. So I think he thought of himself as an insider, and I'm not sure whether the general authorities were that sure that he was an insider. I think they were very troubled by his relationship with the members of the Reorganized Church. But they were his family, and he'd been very close to them as a child. And so it would have been very difficult for him to disown them. He had a letter from Don Carlos's daughter, who became the Poet Laureate of California, Josephine. And I didn't use any of her letter in this because just felt honor-bound not to. In her letter, she said, please destroy this and don't let anybody see it.
Heart-rending letter. I wish I could have used it, but I didn't feel I should. So he was trusted, but I'm sure he felt himself as an insider. I don't know whether that answers it or not. And I don't know where... I don't think lines were drawn so specifically as they are today.
Did you hear the question in the back? The question was whether there was a rivalry within the hierarchy over who had the line of
more direct line of
revelation through the Spirit between the president of the church and the patriarch.
No, I don't think there was. In actual fact, it's such a convoluted question and answer. I don't know whether you would want me to spend time on it, but it goes way back. During the time of Joseph Smith, there was no problem. They were working together, Hiram and Joseph, and even signed many publications presidents, plural, of the church. He was associate president. But after Joseph and Hiram died, William really highlighted a problem. And I don't think the question was so much who had the greatest inspiration, but I think that both William and not John, not the two Johns, but Hiram G. certainly referred to Doctrine and Covenants 1:24, where the patriarch was sustained first. This didn't mean that he was the president of the church or ran the church, and it makes that clear in the following verses, but it was an honorary primal position, just as the Old Testament patriarchs had. But the difficulty was in separating those two lines of authority, and that did cause a big problem. And that's a classical Weberian dilemma. You know, you can't have two kinds of authority. Yes, Levina.
In contrast to
Levina wanted to know if any of the wives had any not input, but certainly influence. No. The only instance I've found of that was Lucy Mack. When Joseph Sr. gave a blessing, she added hers. And but the others, I think that some of the wives felt a sense of loss that their husbands travelled around so much, because the church patriarch had no geographic limitation on where he could give blessings. State patriarchs could only give blessings in their own area. That has changed somewhat since the demise of the office of presiding patriarch. That's more or less a comment that... Do you want to repeat?
I'll just repeat it for the sake of the tape, and correct me if I get it wrong. What he's saying is that Levina, the wife of Hiram, the first wife...
No, she was Jerusha. Hiram's first wife was... His Levina child was Levina.
Levina was the daughter of Jerusha.
Right.
Okay. Right. Anyway, that lineage felt that they were not as much on the inside as the lineage that came through Mary Fielding Smith, as far as there being distinctions made. And at that point was made clear to them.
And I think that's true. You know, that happens in families, but I think that's true, yeah. No, I don't think there was more tolerance, but it wasn't quite so clear-cut. I'm not sure... Well, I just think that church records, for instance, were not so important as they are today. And I think that I don't see any evidence. For instance, when people were excommunicated, they'd be back in the church the next week. There was one man disfellowshipped because his dog barked. And someone else was excommunicated for holding a woman's hand in sacrament meeting when she wasn't his wife. I mean, there are some very interesting things, and so excommunication then, or being cut off the church, was not such a dire thing as it is today, and so who knows who was in the church and who was out from week to week.
Sounds like more an attention-getting device. Are there any other questions? Well, hearing none, that concludes this session. Thank you.